Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. We're especially grateful to newcomers. If you have any questions about how City Club operates or ideas for future programs, please talk with one of our board members, who I'll ask to stand up now. All right. Each table should have a table host who is a member of the City Club. Hosts can answer your questions or direct you to someone else who can help. Several quick reminders about the mechanics. Please silence your cell phones. Raise your hand if you have trouble hearing. We hope everyone participates in the table discussions during the break, but only City Club members can ask questions at the microphone. Make a note, next week we will meet at the Downtown Athletic Club on the third floor. It is our tradition to treat members, guests, and ideas with courtesy and to respond thoughtfully, whether we find them appealing or not. The City Club is a great place for lively but rational discourse, which makes for good radio too. Okay, welcome members and guests to the February 12th program of the City Club of Eugene, Media Portrayals of Immigrants. I'm James Baldock, City Club President. Our sponsors today are the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County, committed to providing safe, affordable, and energy-efficient housing for low-income families, elderly citizens, and persons with disabilities. Pack Info Internet Solutions, the oldest, fastest, friendliest, and most reliable internet solution provider in Lane County. And Funk Levi's and Associates, who care about your brand as much as you do, sometimes more. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space, and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the podcasts on their website. We'd also like to thank Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs Monday through Saturday at noon and Sunday at 9 p.m. We host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year, and today is our 19th program in our 2015-2016 programming year. If you believe that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Mary Layton will introduce today's moderator.
So today's moderator is Chris Chavez, my next-door neighbor. His mother's family has lived since at least the 1800s in a small pueblo called Parepero in the Mexican state of Michoacán. His grandmother immigrated to California in 1927 and gave birth to Chris's mother, Olivia, in East Los Angeles. He describes two defining factors of his early years. I was poor and I was Latino. For the first 10 years after graduating from Cal State Pomona with a degree in marketing, he worked as an ad man and an account manager in San Francisco and Boston. He then spent a few years acquiring more degrees. His dissertation, which his children explained to me, was Hispanic Advertising as a Social Organization, an examination of the advertising industry as a field of cultural production. He taught communications courses at USC and St. Louis University before coming to the University of Oregon for a tenure-track position. Last year, he won the Outstanding Early Career Award for Research Excellence at the University of Oregon. He has published two books and quite a lot of journal articles, and he goes every summer to Ghana with a group of students learning how to do marketing for the activities there. His most recently published book, Reinventing the Latino Television Viewer, Language, Ideology, and Practice, examines how the relationship between language power and industry practice is reshaping the very concept of Hispanic. Chris will introduce the panelists and moderate the discussion of how media shape our perception of immigrants. Chris? Panelists?
Thank you very much for attending today's panel on the media portrayals of immigrants. Before I introduce our panelists today, and we'll get into the discussion in earnest, I'd like to offer a few words as a frame. Today I want to talk a bit about borders. Borders are strange things. They are not found in nature, and yet they are presented as the natural order of things. In his own work on borders, Walter Mignolo has described maps as fictions, stating that how we represent space is not arbitrary. Instead, how somebody categorizes, imagines, and institutionalizes space is based on power relations, and when where one lies in the social space determines their position in the power structure and therefore their perspective. You see, borders can be transformative. As bodies cross borders, they leave one social context and enter into another. And in doing so, these bodies become changed. They are the spaces where citizen becomes alien, where legal becomes illegal, and resident becomes ethnic. And so here we find ourselves at a unique moment in history. Migration has always been a part of the human experience, but the speed and scale at which bodies are crossing borders is unprecedented. And so is the precision by which we are policing borders. Consequently, there's an urgency to how we talk about migration today. Within these discourses, Latinos occupy a unique space in popular imagination today. As the 2016 presidential debate season continues to play out, U.S. Latinos have not fared particularly well. In an effort to address the problem of immigration, Latinos have already been framed as anchor babies, rapists, and convicts. But while Latinos have been the subjects of political rhetoric, they have not necessarily been engaged directly in civic discourses, including journalistic representation. So the purpose of this panel is to provide some context and perspective on the issue. And to help us sort this out, I have a distinguished panel from the University of Oregon who I'll introduce right now. First, we have Dr. Julie Wise, is an assistant professor in history at the University of Oregon. Dr. Wise's teaching and research explores themes of identity, citizenship, and migration. Dr. Wise is the author of Corazón de Dixie, Mexicanos in the U.S. South since 1910, and is currently working on her new book project, Citizenship Displaced, Migrant Panel Political Cultures in the Area of the State Control. Next to her is Ricardo Valencia, who's a doctoral student in the School of Journalism and Communication. Ricardo worked as the head of communication and public relations at the Department of El Salvador Embassy in Washington, D.C. During his career, he's been a columnist, an investigative reporter, a senior editor and correspondent for various newspapers and agencies in El Salvador. With a grant from the Center of Latino and Latin American Studies, Ricardo has conducted a study on how newspapers are reporting on unaccompanied children from El Salvador. And finally, we have Aaliyah Kiley, who is a master's student in the School of Journalism and Communication. Aaliyah's research focuses on media representation in marginalized communities. She is the co-author of Starlet's Subscribers and Beneficiaries, Disney Latino Children and Television Labor, which is currently under review at the International Journal of Communication. So I'll begin with a few questions for each of our panelists. We'll have a bit of discussion, and then I'll open it up to the City Club at large. So we'll first start with Dr. Wise. Your work focuses a bit on Latino immigrants and issues of belonging and citizenship. How have Latino immigrants historically been presented via news discourses?
Thank you for the question, Christopher. Thank you all for having me here. I think the first thing we have to remember when we're thinking about the long history of the way that Latino immigrants have been represented in American culture and in the media is that if we go back 100 years, or at this point slightly more than 100 years, we see that actually in the early 20th century, people were not actually that worried about what at that time was Mexican immigrants predominantly. People were very worried about Chinese immigrants. That was the number one target of anti-immigrant discourse in the late 19th and early 20th century. And people were increasingly concerned about the wrong kind of European immigrants, Jews, Italians, Poles, Russian, Greeks, those European immigrants that were considered less white and in fact racially inferior to European immigrants from places like Norway and England. And so if you go back to the early 20th century, a big part of the reason why we had so much Mexican immigration, exactly, I believe you said your grandmother came in 1927?
Yep.
So that's exactly was the first wave of Mexican immigration to the United States, the first large wave. And that was because, in fact, nobody was really that worried about it. And people were much more worried about other immigrant groups. And so because Chinese and increasingly European immigrants were being kept out, someone had to do the work, which led to a great increase in recruitment of immigrants from Mexico in the early 20th century. So over time, that changed. The sense that people were not that worried about this particular immigrant group changed over time. And what I want to point to, and I think something to keep our eyes out for as you listen to the news now, are that there has really been a fluctuation in what I would argue are two sort of main ways of conceiving of the costs and benefits of Latino immigration, which I'll say Latino immigration, but really prior to the 1980s, we were really talking predominantly about Mexican immigration, somewhat Puerto Rican and Dominican, but really predominantly Mexican immigration. And so the longer history, both with Mexican immigrants and with other immigrants, the longer history is debating about them as workers, as producers. So one side says they're taking our jobs, they're working for cheaper, they are reducing the wages of hardworking Americans. The other side, often represented by business, says and has said, they're doing jobs Americans won't do. My industry can't thrive in the United States unless I can get a hold of these immigrant workers. Their work ethic is so strong. They work harder and longer than native workers, U.S. American workers. Often what was coded in that was a criticism of someone else, criticizing African Americans, criticizing poor white people, criticizing someone in comparison to Mexican immigrants. And so that is really the longer history, even going back to anti-Chinese sentiment. It was all about debating whether the idea of Mexicans as workers were good or bad for the country, and whether you were an employer of those workers or whether you were someone who perceived that you were in competition with them would affect which messages you were putting out and which messages you were receiving in the media. And the truth is that for most of U.S. history, it was the employers that had the upper hand in shaping the media narratives. And so it was the employers that were putting out into the public view these very strong messages that we need them, especially during and after World War II, this sense that this labor is absolutely necessary. They're birds of passage, don't worry, they'll go home, they're not going to stick around, they're not going to threaten our lifestyle or our sense of cultural or racial identity. And so that's really was the more dominant media narrative. And then you would have leaders in something like the labor movement, at times even including Mexican-American leaders, such as Cesar Chavez, speaking out against the labor competition. But all of this debate was along the question of whether these were beneficial or harmful for the American economy, for American workers, for American business. And as you can imagine, as long as business was more powerful, they actually dominated the images. Now, we could also point out that constructing Mexicans as these perfect workers certainly denied other parts of their humanity, denied the fact that they might fall in love, they might want to have a child, they might want to have a family. There's a great quote from a Swiss writer about the labor recruitment that happened in Europe after World War II at the same time as we were recruiting many Mexicans to the U.S., where he said, "We called for labor, but people came instead." So they called for labor and people came instead. And I think that leads us to the change in this discourse, which I peg, we were just talking at our table that many of us here are from California, and which I peg to something that happened when I was growing up in California and was the thing that piqued my interest in Latino studies, which was the immigration debate in California in the 1990s, specifically around Proposition 187. Many of you are probably going to remember that. It was a ballot initiative that sought to cut off services, even Supreme Court mandated services, such as emergency medical care or K-12 education, to undocumented immigrants. And it passed with a majority vote, but could never go into effect because it was unconstitutional. And that was where we saw the start of a new discourse. That's where I pegged that we saw the start of a new discourse, which was not debating their role in the labor force, but debating the role of Latinos, and now it was more broadly Latinos, as consumers of public resources. The idea that they're taking our tax dollars that they don't deserve. They don't deserve either because they're supposedly not paying taxes, which turns out to be inaccurate, or they don't deserve simply because they're not American, they're not white, they're not one of us. And what I think, you know, my own expertise is on the South. When you see anti-immigrant movements happening in the South now, they learned it from California. California, in my view, really invented the idea that we should focus on not what immigrants are contributing or not contributing to the economy as workers, but on what they are taking from the economy as consumers of public education and healthcare services specifically. Because even though undocumented immigrants cannot get welfare benefits, and even legal immigrants cannot get many welfare benefits, their children are in school. And so what I think is interesting is that often when you hear the pro-immigrant side on the media, they're still caught up, in my view, in that previous discussion about, well, they're doing jobs Americans won't do, they work so hard, we need them for our economy. They're still caught up in that previous conversation. And I don't hear a very strong discourse on the other side of the argument about Latinos as consumers of public resources. So you have one side saying, I pay my taxes and I want those taxes to go to funding my child's education. But he showed up at what was supposedly this great school district, but around the corner from my house was a trailer park where a lot of poor Latino families are living. And now my kid is competing for resources, for the teacher's time, for the seat in that classroom, for books and other public resources with these kids who don't deserve to be here. And in truth, I think we're all anxious. I'm not a parent yet. But we're all anxious about how our children will fare in an increasingly competitive economy. And so I absolutely have empathy for parents who are trying to do the best for their families and want those resources for their kid in a new and changing economy that depends upon intellectual development more so than hard labor. My own view is that they're casting the blame in the wrong direction in terms of why the economy is so difficult and will be difficult for all of our children to maintain or achieve a middle-class status. But these are the anxieties that I think are more projected now. And so I think often you see these op-eds saying, no, they're taking jobs Americans won't do. Maybe they lower wages, but only a little bit and only in certain industries. Don't you want fresh fruit? They're focusing on Latinos as workers, but I don't yet see a very strong discourse to counter the accusation that Latinos are undeserving consumers. And so that is what I sort of often would like to see among people who are trying to give a different narrative in the media than the one that's out there. And I think I'll just say briefly before concluding that I think these two narratives resonate in different communities. The idea of immigrants as labor competition resonates more in working class communities, while the idea that immigrants are competition for public resources resonates more in middle and even upper middle class communities. And in fact, when you look at the last 10 years and see prior to Trump where the anti-immigrant sentiment was coming from, I identify it where it was coming from with political meat, where representatives are introducing state-level legislation in response to this sentiment. It was middle-class suburbs. So I think, again, the media is often caught in this narrative that, oh, working-class people feel competition with immigrants. Maybe they do in certain sectors, maybe like construction. However, that's actually not prior to the Trump phenomenon where we really saw the energy for anti-immigrant movements coming from. The people that wrote Prop 187 were dentists, accountants, middle-class white Californians living in Orange County. And in fact, I was just told by someone that the people who wrote the Alabama anti-immigrant legislation were middle-class transplants from Thousand Oaks, California. So I think we need to reframe our idea of who is it that's receiving these media narratives. Working class, yes, that's been for all of industrial era U.S. history, that sense of competition. But I think what's newer for the last 25 years is really this focus more on Latinos as consumers. And so I think as we, consumers of public goods, so as I think we listen to media messages, I think we should keep those two straight. And when people want to argue or give a different narrative, they should, I think, be aware of into which conversation they're entering.
Ricardo, I wanted to tap into a point that Dr. Wise is making in terms of who gets to craft the narrative, who gets to shape the narrative, and oftentimes it's folks that own businesses, politicians, people in power. And this seems to dovetail a lot with the research that you did on journalistic practices. Can you talk briefly about your findings about who gets to be cited for stories on immigration? Where do these stories come from? Because it seems to dig into some of the meat of actual journalistic practice.
Well, I analyzed two sets of newspapers in one group, the newspaper with high concentrations of Central Americans and also Latinos, New York Times, Los Angeles Times. And I compared it to two newspapers with low concentration of Central Americans, specifically not necessarily Latinos, but in this case was where the Oregonian and the Seattle Times. And I wanted to find if there was some correlation or some relation between if you have more access to Latino sources, you quote more Latino sources. And I was expecting to see that the New York Times and Los Angeles Times quote more Latino sources. But what happened is that's why I did the research, to confirm or reject my own opinions. But what you read here from the Oregonian and what the people in Seattle read about uncompanioned children, specifically the flow or the phenomenon that happened in May 2014, is similar. If you are here in Oregon, or if you are in Los Angeles, or you are in New York, because there's a trend of nationalizing the issue. And big newspapers frame the news, and then they create the narrative. And because it's nationalized, we can see a trend of choosing the powerful, in this case, politicians, non-Latinos. And I'll pay attention to this juncture because I thought, well, for the first time, Latinos and Central Americans will be visible because it's a Latino issue. The issue of unaccompanied children, Latino politicians can raise the flag and go and defend the interests of our community. But I found that still the news pattern of constructing news is still privileging non-Latinos and people with access to politicians in high position of power. Latinos are mostly in the peripheral areas. They are only quoted as immigrants, part of non-profits, some politicians, but the people who framed the discourse regarding this situation were politicians in the Congress. And another interesting finding is women are only 15% of the source of information for these newspapers. They are more anonymous sources, people who are in position of power, who doesn't have to give the name and their position, and it means like there are more people without faces that talk about this situation, this phenomenon, than women. And I believe there's a part that I analyzed that I think is very interesting because I focus on the Oregonian. And 56 articles published in the Oregonian were crafted by staff writers. And they were crafted and they were placed in the national information section. They were placed in the world section. Like when you're talking about Gaza, Palestine, Israel, Cuba, they placed the story in that section, which suggests maybe people who have analyzed or examined Oregon, which should suggest that still in this state, people think about immigration as something that is strange, foreign. It's not part of our community. This issue in the border is not an issue. That's why we don't have enough resources to cover it. That's why we need to get the information from the Washington Post, the New York Times, Associated Press. And yes, and in this way, I can understand what happened last year with the proposal to give undocumented immigrants driver license. I think people in general don't think they are Latinos or that we are not that strong as we are. And I saw some data, like in 2000, 80% of the population of Oregon were Latinos, and now are 11.7%. I think it's growing, but still there's a concept, I think reproduced by the media, that there's a few Mexicans, a few Central Americans who are doing, they're having their small restaurants of Mexican food, Central American food, but there are more. Well, I'm here. One example. and I think that this is very interesting because I think it impacts policy. Like if people don't read, there are a good amount, new number of Latinos, people tend to forget it's not an issue that they have to discuss.
I think your point that women only occupy 15% of cited sources, which means their voice, they don't get to speak on the issue, right? And that they occupy an important part in popular imagination, women's bodies, but particularly Latina women's bodies. And Aaliyah, that fits into some of the research that you do on the visual tropes and the themes and how Latina women's bodies have become politicized. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for having me. So I think what both Julie and Ricardo touched on that I think that I can expand on here is that we know that there's a racist legacy of really anti-immigration and racist rhetoric in the contemporary media landscape, both in news journalism and in popular media. So what we notice in more overtly historical times is that these representations are very stereotypical, right? They present Latinos as bad, as evil, as antagonists, or as harlots who are really threatening, you know, the white woman's marriage and really subverting all of these terrible things, you know, family values. So there are these very directly stereotypical representations. And we can see some legacies and some enduring images persist today, despite the civil rights movement, despite a lot of the gains that we've made. A lot of these tropes persist. So for men, we often see men as macho, sexist, violent, aggressive. We see them as drug lords or as lazy laborers, which is a really interesting contradiction. And for women, I think it gets a little bit more complicated, right? Because women tend to be objects of desire and they tend to be fantasized about. So some of the representations get a little bit more ambiguous. So women are either presented asexually or hypersexually. So when we see asexual representations, we can see that in the domestic laborer, in the maid, who tends to be a darker-skinned, heavily accented Latina woman. Rosario Salazar in Will and Grace is a really great example of this. Or there's a hypersexualization as the harlot or the female clown, in which a very sexualized object of desire is often muted by either being comic relief. We can think Eva Longoria here in Desperate Housewives and her new show Telenovela, in which she is a very sexualized woman, but is constantly in these very physical, comedic situations, kind of like an I Love Lucy situation. So her sexuality gets kind of tamed in that way. And we can also think of Sofia Vergara in Modern Family, where she's a new spin on the harlot. She's very impassioned. She's reactive. She's a victim to her passions and her emotions. But she also gets tamed by being very noble, by having a strong sense of family values that oftentimes the other white family members can't even see. She represents that difference to help reflect those values. So we think about, what are these images telling us, and what are these shifting representations telling us? And I think there's really a tension right now in our cultural moment and in this media moment where we have this anti-immigration racist rhetoric that has a long enduring history. And then we have waves of, you know, generations of immigrants that are still here, that have been here for 3 and 4 generations and are coming in regularly, dramatically changing the demographics of this state and this country. And we want to tap into that buying power, right? We want to see them as consumers, see them as viewers. We want them as subscribers to the Disney Channel. We want them to buy Dora backpacks. So how do we negotiate that tension? How do we maintain this anti-immigrant and kind of racist rhetoric while easing that anxiety? So that tends to happen and get politicized through a two-step process. And that process that we've seen is evoking fear, and that's done through news media that primarily focuses on men, and it focuses on men as, you know, immigrant threats that are going to come and steal your job, a lot of what Julie talked about, and or drug cartels and illegal drug trade where, you know, it's chaotic and terrifying. So that fear is evoked in the news media, and then it's eased by the indirect focus on Latinas and children. And so in popular media, we see an overrepresentation of women and children over men. And so often what happens is women and children become more palatable. They become a little bit more consumable. Women do that by, as I said, becoming fantasized about, becoming sexual objects. And so they can be tamed and kind of consumed in that way. And children become representatives of a very sanitized and safe sense of migration and of immigration. So we can think of Dora and Diego, who are often on their journey, and they're using maps, and they're in transit, and they're traveling, and they're really telling a very sanitized story of children's migration into this country. And so when we have these very sanitized and safe representations, we can then erase the more complicated, more direct forms of racial politics, because we live in a post-racial, colorblind society in which Dora can represent all Latinos, and traveling over the border isn't that bad, and she's got her little map in her backpack that can produce any kind of amazing items. So it really is erasing these long histories, legacies, and lived realities. And I think that by focusing in popular media on women and children, again, that's this way to indirectly diffuse some of those real racial politics going on today, and to really cultivate and to access a very large consumer market, which I think is something that's going to continue today.
We get on time, or we keep going? Okay.
Thank you. Today's topic, media portrayals of immigrants. Our today's topic is media portrayals of immigrants. Our speakers are Dr. Christopher Chavez, Ricardo Valencia, Aaliyah Kiley, and Dr. Julie Wise. We'll break now for a few minutes and then return with members' questions.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Okay, we have about 27 minutes left for questions, so feel free to ask them, and we'll get started now. Thank you. Today's topic, Welcome back to the February 12th City Club program, Media Portrayals of Immigrants. Our guest speakers are Dr. Christopher Chavez, Ricardo Valencia, Aaliyah Kiley, and Dr. Julie Wise. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each.
I'm John Anningman, City Club member since 2003. And looking out at this group, I see a lot of descendants from immigrants, including my grandparents, who beat World War I and got out of Germany just in time to avoid that. But the question that I have for you today concerns other groups of immigrants, including your own. How would you compare the images of Latinos in the United States of America with the present image of Chinese immigrants? Mm-hmm. Anybody want to hear?
The question was about the present image of Chinese?
I'm sorry, what?
The question was about the current, present-day image of Chinese?
That's correct.
There does seem to be a discourse about Chinese or Asian Americans, particularly as ideal immigrants, hardworking, middle class, that will go into schools, make schools succeed, and they are often seen as a antithesis of Latino immigrants who are often depicted as not as smart, a drain on resources, not contributing to school. So these can often seem as counterpoints to one another, in fact, to support the argument that it is a cultural flaw or a flaw of a particular community that they're not performing up to standards rather than institutional biases. So oftentimes these groups will be used in conflict with another.
And actually, scholars have traced back the origin of when did people, you know, when did it change? When did Chinese immigrants go from being really the most despised to being seen as these model minority immigrants? And there is one article, I believe it was Time magazine in the late 60s or early 70s, where they were explicitly compared to African Americans. It was explicitly said, here's a group that has suffered discrimination for 100 years, but they're getting ahead and they're having all these accomplishments. What accounts for that? And so it was very clearly in the context of the civil rights movement and African-American claims for redress of historical discrimination that Asian-Americans began to be held up as this model minority. But I think with that said, there is, you know, at least if you're on the West Coast, I think there's at least some talk also about this baby tourism. I don't know if that resonates at all, but there has been increasing coverage about sort of houses, especially in Southern California, where people come from Asia on tourist visas specifically to have babies who can become U.S. citizens. And so I think that's maybe one small echo of that anchor baby discourse, the idea that Latinos are coming here just to have babies who are U.S. citizens who can then claim resources. I think that's maybe one area where you see some convergence, but I think, as Christopher pointed out, that anchor baby concern is 9 times out of 10 going to be directed against Latinos, but 1 time out of 10 you will read in the newspaper about some of this so-called baby tourism.
And that really came to the fore during the coverage of the Jeb Bush campaign, where he was asked about anchor babies, which tend to be associated with Latinos, and he had made the point, as Dr. Wise did, that in many cases it's Asian-American immigrants. And it created a really weird cultural moment where the press didn't know how to respond, Jeb Bush didn't know how to respond, but it does bring some of these issues up to the fore.
Camilla Pratt, City Club member. Our table is curious about how social media is affecting immigrant groups. And a corollary is the older members of the immigrant community and the younger.
Well, when I lived in Washington, D.C., I was there from 2010 to 2014. People have this idea that poor immigrants, even if they are 40 years old, they don't have Facebook. But I think I was in neighborhoods with Latinos, working class Latinos in Washington, D.C., in places with, and I was surprised to see that even people who are over 40 or 50 years old, they have their Facebook pages, because it's the only way. I think Facebook, in my case, also my family, part of my family is in Mexico, part of my family is in El Salvador, and some of my family are here in the United States. I think it's like in the interface that you can be in a single space at the same time. And I think the idea that young Latinos, the people who were born here, they use it perhaps in a more sophisticated way. But older Latinos, people who came across the border, who came to work, they also use a lot of internet. And also, they read a lot of newspapers in their countries, and they construct a narrative. Like yesterday, I was talking to a very good friend, she is a Mexican American. She lives in San Jose, and her family is from Chihuahua, Mexico. And she was telling me how she combines, even if she's a native speaker, it's an English native speaker. She combines what she reads in the New York Times with whatever happens in Univision, and she creates a narrative. Because she believes American English media doesn't represent what her mother and her father feels. And I think it's happened the same with social media. It's a combination of things. It's not that young people use more. I think they use it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting field of research.
I think also when we're speaking about social media and a lot of underrepresented or minority, soon to be not minority in many places, groups, is again a tension between the potential for socio-political mobilization or for more democratic representation, but then it's sometimes these dynamics get kind of tempered by the co-opting of these spaces by large corporations or by economic interests. So I think where there's the potential to have socio-political mobilization or more diverse voices, oftentimes these social media outlets get kind of translated into consumer citizenship, so where people are participating more as consumer citizens, as retweeting or talking about, you know, shows that are on TV or fashion blogs or different kinds of cultural elements that they can participate in, rather than because they've been shut out from more political arenas, then they tend to gravitate towards more cultural citizenship and more consumptive areas of direct democratic engagement.
May I ask a question of my fellow panelists? I'm curious, my understanding, especially when I was living in Los Angeles, was that radio, and this was, let's say, 5-10 years ago, that radio continued to be perhaps, this was my impression, not as a media studies person, the number one mobilizing media medium. I remember when 500,000 people took to the streets for immigrants' rights marches, the biggest demonstration in Los Angeles since the Vietnam era. And literally, all the white activists had not gotten the memo. Like, we just hadn't gotten the memo that this was going to be happening, because it was all happening on Spanish language radio. And I'm just curious, from you media studies people, is that still the case? Does radio in the places that have Spanish radio still occupy the number one slot of how someone would spread the word about an activist opportunity type thing? Or do you feel like social media is actually even creeping up or eclipsing radio?
I believe radio is so important. At least my experience, when I was working in the embassy, our main outlet to reach community was radio, because we are sure that they want to listen to their music, they want to feel comfortable, they don't want to hear some representation of our community in the radio, and they listen all the. We used to funnel and target radio if we want some kind of participation of the community, because we were sure that they were listening to the radio. This is really important.
And I think a lot of it will depend on how you define the community, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a uniform group that, you know, is same level of acculturation, same linguistic proficiencies. But amongst working class Latinos, radio does still to be tend to be a strong medium. I think it's Dolores Del Rio who writes about Spanish language radio. It's a place where if you're working class and Spanish speaking, you're not going to be scorned for being so. It's easily accessible in many workspaces. But amongst younger cultured Latinos, they're very prolific users of social media. So in that case, as the discourses have shifted over the past 5 years, there used to be the argument that Latinos were on the opposite end of the digital divide, meaning that wealthy white tended to have better access to internet connection, to computers, and Latinos, African Americans were left behind. That conversation has flipped. So if you read Nielsen data, they're actually arguing that they are more prolific users. Latinos are more prolific users of social media than their Anglo counterparts or as the population in general. So they tweet more, they share more, they like more. So they're much more conversant in the language of social media. And I think Ricardo's right. That does. There are two different discourses on that. Are they using it to maintain connections to the home country because now it's easier to access blogs, video, content from the home country? But I think it's more of a cultural bricolage where you're drawing in information globally. Now media is not bounded by the nation state or the geographic region. We really can draw music, content, infographics from everywhere in the world, so we can construct these really interesting, fascinating identities that in some ways are only loosely tied to nation state.
Thank you so much for bringing up that topic of social media and the radio. My question was more geared towards, and I'm thinking about this a lot lately, was there seems to be sort of this unreined way that the media kind of, specifically video, you know, newscasts, portrays Latinos. Should we be keeping journalists accountable? And if so, how would that even look like?
So I'll be really quickly. Yes, I think we should. I think that when we look at the national news media landscape and the local one, if you review the Register Guard or any of the local news affiliates, I think that considering the large demographic numbers in the country, in the state, and the historical legacies, there's a dramatic underrepresentation in the news media. There's just not that many stories. And then when you do see stories, it tends to be very problem saturated. So they're talking about discrimination and underrepresentation on the UO campus, underperformance for students in high school and middle school and elementary school. They talk about local and social programs in order to help poor Latino families. There was a Latino Awareness Day. And though I think these stories, surprisingly actually to me, are very well written and very important and raising a lot of complicated issues facing the many Latino communities today, there's a problem when there isn't something else to balance it out. So when the only stories we're seeing are problem-saturated stories and seeing Latinos as social problems, then we see people and Latino individuals as undereducated, poor, even diseased or criminal. And so I think we do have to hold them accountable in order to just balance out these representations. There are more stories to be told, there's more nuance, there's, you know, a variety of lived experience that doesn't get told when we focus on a very small part of the population or a very specific part of that population, which is the problem narrative.
And again, that's a really complicated question, right? So why do we have these limited tropes and images and a limited vocabulary for talking about Latinos? Any number of reasons, right? The diversity in newsrooms do not reflect the diversity of the population in general. There are limited practices, right? So journalists tend to rely on the same templates for writing stories, right? We have primed audience to consume images that they recognize. There are a whole host of reasons why this happens. The question is, what do we do as consumers of media? You know, and to what do we count? How can we battle that? I think at a very minimum level, you know, consumer citizenship, you can consume or not consume. You can either choose to buy that newspaper or not buy that newspaper, which is a very basic act. Is that agency enough? At the individual level, no. At the mass level, possibly. It could be something as active as a boycott, a demonstration, a letter to an editor, making your voice heard in any kind of way. But it seems to be that consumption in some ways is, I think, the only agency that consumers feel that they have. And then the last thing is alternative forms of media. Right now we do have the mainstream press, but then we have alternative press like Univision, Fusion, people that are looking at the issues in slightly different ways. So rewarding those kinds of stories.
And I'll just add, there is one precedent I'm thinking of, which was the Ban the I-Word campaign, where activists were really putting pressure on newspapers and media outlets not to use the word illegal and to use undocumented instead. And my sense was that not all, but many media outlets actually caved in and responded and said, yeah, we're going to change in response to this pressure. So there is some precedent that this can work.
Lisa Arkin, City Club, and I think this question from our table allows you to follow up a little more on what you're talking about. So if you were on the editorial board of a newspaper, what would be the top two or three recommendations you would make to your staff to shift the conversations in a more positive way about Latinos in the media?
I might say first, hire more Latinos journalists. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to have more voices. And the second one is don't constrain Latinos journalists to cover Latino issues. You need to train non-Latino reporters to cover Latino issues. Otherwise, we are reproducing the same thing, leaving Latinos reporters only to cover ethnic issues. And the third one is to see when the intersection, how these people live, cover more information about news, create more articles about how these people live, but also how they interact with other communities. Because there's an idea that Latino community is like isolated and is only about itself. The dynamics are only internal dynamics, but never about interaction. And sometimes I'm surprised. Every place I go to the kitchens and I see Latinos, and they are cooking Asian food, French food. Like, I remember Washington, D.C., I have friends who were Salvadorians, but they were cooking. They have a long history of cooking in kitchens of French restaurants, Japanese restaurants. And that's something that I need to be addressed. But not only hire Latinos immigrant reporters to cover Latino issues. Why don't like the media, train non-Latino reporters? A lot of them speak Spanish, train them to cover non-Latino issues. I mean, we are part of the society. We are not a segregated part of the society. And that might be my three suggestions, if you allow me. If somebody asked me about how to improve the visibility of our community.
Jane Smith, City Club member for some years. This is somewhat of a personal confession question. When our moderator finished, I realized I was astonished at how articulate and what presence you had. And I thought, how could I think that? And I apologize. I feel a great affinity for Latinos as a woman, because as a woman in the business community for 20 years, I tended to be put down, disparaged, left out when the decisions were made in the men's bathroom, that kind of stuff. And I gradually saw that change, although I'm told that pay is still not equal. As a white woman, I was still very privileged, certainly outside that business sector, much more privileged than Latino companions. I grew up in Hawaii, and that's different. And in many institutions, Hawaiians, whites are the discriminated one. But we have the whole history of the country and the world saying whites are okay. I'd like to ask the question, in order to sort of narrow my focus, would you say that Latinos want a balance of power to make, on a personal level and a group level, their own decisions about their own futures and their own direction? or do you want some recognition of ethnic difference, that is, being bilingual, having customs that are different from the customs of some other sort of standard white people? I really think I need the answer to that to know where I'm going in this new world. I know the balance of power to some extent will be taken care of. As someone pointed out, whites are going to be in the minority sooner or later. So shall we hope for the sooner? Thank you.
I don't know if I could speak to the Latino community or what they want. I would suspect that many people just want to operate with dignity and to be able to exist in the world without having to be marginalized or isolated. And I think it might be as simple as that.
And I think that when we're talking about the media, and I think you were drawing on notions of feminism and women's rights and women's issues and making parallels there, and I think that a big part is to remember that no oppressive category, gender or race or class, functions in isolation, that everything intersects and affects people in different ways, and that a key part of that is then to really reinforce and to promote self-definition, that, you know, I can't define what you as a white woman and me as a white woman, I can't tell you what, you know, your definition of power or your definition of identity is going to be, just like, you know, one Latino group can't define that for another. So I think there, especially when we're talking about media, that self-definition is huge. And as Ricardo suggested, you know, really encouraging there to be more Latino representations, more voices, more self-definition, so that we can kind of contradict some of those controlling images and we can really have more of a public discourse about what would be helpful. I think there's some common themes about what would be helpful, obviously not being discriminated against, having access to different resources, having access to citizenship, having access to jobs. So I think there's some common themes, but I think self-definition is really key. Mm-hmm. And I think promoting self-definition through alternative forms of media and as practitioners, it's really important to have people speak for themselves.
And thinking about also the previous question in relation to this one about, you know, what are the stories that need to be covered, I'm just endlessly fascinated by youth, which is why it's great that I get to teach them. And, you know, when I taught at Cal State Long Beach, which had a significant, about one-third of the students were Latino, we shouldn't assume even that Latino is the identity. I mean, it was a part of the identity for most of the students, but I had students who had grown up, Koreatown is majority Latino, so I had multiple Latino students that wanted to study abroad in Korea in order to reinforce the Korean part of their identity that they had gained in high school with Korean students. I had a student who had grown up among Armenians in North Hollywood, California, and her study abroad was to Russia because she felt this strong connection to the Armenian culture, and Russian was a way to access that. This, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I truly have no idea here at a place like North Eugene High School, where Latinos are a significant presence, but not necessarily like the 99% that you might have grown up with in East Los Angeles. What are their identities? How do they identify? What do they want? I actually really don't know, but I know that it's really fascinating. And I think that can also just help you get beyond, you know, either it's the failing gangster or it's the girl going to Princeton that we read about, which was such an amazing story in the Eugene Register Guard about the recent immigrant who's now going to Princeton from one of the public high schools in Eugene. You know, it's not just those two. There's just such a fascinating array. And what do they want? Someone's got to just ask them.
Randy Prince, City Club member. Our table was not only interested in whether and how we should hold the news and entertainment media responsible for negative stereotypes, but also who, because it was mentioned the nationalization of our culture, and it's certainly true in news. Less news is generated locally, not only commercial, but even public radio. It's more centralized. So we kind of might think of a national news as maybe being more enlightened, New York values, you know, and we wouldn't say things as overtly racist. On the other hand, people in local communities exist, ethnic minorities, and many people exist fairly well together and don't say such nasty things, although there are cases where it is very polarized. So do you feel that the problem of these unfair negative stereotypes in the media is being increased by the nationalization of our culture and news and entertainment, or is that maybe helping in the long term? And either way, where do you think we should focus our efforts, with our local news reporters or telling the networks we're not going to buy the products that advertise on the bad shows and so on?
I mean, I think whenever we're talking about, and this maybe would be a panel for a different day, but when we're talking about the concentration of media ownership, which is an increasing trend, we tend to see less diversity of representation. And I don't just mean diversity as in racial identity or ethnic identity. I mean diversity of stories being told, because they're all centralized and, you know, the ownership is increasingly concentrated, and then it's recycled content. So I think whenever that's happening, we definitely want to always advocate for broader discourses, for more diverse discourses, and for more alternative stories being told across the board.
And just to tap into that, I mean, that's such a big question in terms of thinking about media, whether it's television or newspaper, journalism, radio, as both an economic product and a public good. And the FCC's always really tried to balance between the two. And you see the pendulum swing over time. There has been tremendous consolidation, which that means is it's not good for the public, because we only see one story, right? We don't see the diversity of stories. If we do see a range of stories, they tend to come from the same company, even though they may have different outlets. So more and more of what we consume is coming by fewer and fewer people, which means single voices dominate how we conceptualize childhood, how we conceptualize women, how we conceptualize ethnic minorities, and that is not good for communities. What individual newspapers might be able to do is think of how that discourse not only falls in line with that national discourse, but how it could complicate it, or how it might contest it, or provide a different facet of it. The more voices you have, the more media outlets you have, the more newspapers you have, a society just benefits by having diverse perspectives, because it's through having those multiple points of views and multiple vantage points that you have enlightenment, right? That's where you have knowledge, rather than just having one consistent argument perpetually broadcast to consumers. But I think, in what ways can you diversify stories, diversify media, diversify ownership, I think, would probably be a strong recommendation.
And what I've observed in observing the anti-immigrant movement of the past 15 years is that also social media, which is this great cross-border tool that can reduce the space between Eugene and El Salvador or Russia or anywhere, that social media can also have a nationalizing effect, and that the anti-immigrant movement has used social media very effectively to spread anti-immigrant ideas through the country to places that might not have, in a local fashion, felt that way.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more question, and then we'll just wrap it up.
Be very quick then. Okay.
Well, one step further on the last question. I really think that a lot of the people who control the media narrative are intentionally setting up an us against them scenario so that they can divide and conquer and maintain the status quo. So I was wondering how we change the narrative to make people realize that if we all work together, it would be better for all of us.
I might add something that it's not only an ideological issue. I think it's a material issue. And our communities, Latino communities, have issues of resources, education, and that is reproduced by media too. I think if we try to solve some of the issues of inequalities and visibility, we also have to tackle these material issues that are needed, the social factors that make some people more visible than others. And I think it's important to address those issues.
And just one last point I just wanted to make is that oftentimes the stereotype doesn't work at the sinister level where somebody's in back room saying, you know, I really want to misrepresent somebody, but it happens in those benign everyday practices, right, that goes completely unconscious by the practitioners. Again, it's not overt, but it's just a system that we all are complicit in it. I'm complicit mm-hmm. as a consumer. Practitioners are complicit in it. It goes by unquestioned. So I would say it's not a sinister act, but just sort of, again, the banality of evil, right? It happens in these everyday practices that we engage in on a daily basis that we're completely unconscious of. So it's just a matter, I think, of raising those consciousness and being very, very aware of our practices that we all do myself included, on a daily basis and how we contribute to it. But I think we are currently out of time, so thank you again for your attention on this very, very important issue. I think we could be here all day, but here we are. Thank you.
And thank you, Dr. Christopher Chavez, Ricardo Valencia, Aaliyah Kylie, and Dr. Julia Wise for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club program, Media Portrayals of Immigrants. And thanks again to our sponsors, the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County, PacInfo Internet Solutions, and Funk Levi's and Associates. Special thanks to Cascade Health Solutions for hosting a session of the course Lane County's Economy and Employment, which City Club offers for teachers in collaboration with the Lane ESD and Lane Workforce Partnership. We meet again next on Friday 19th at the Downtown Athletic Club for the program Should Oregon Tax Corporations? Lunches for this program can be ordered on the City Club's website or by contacting the office. This concludes today's wonderful program. Thanks again for the speakers.